This edition of the Optimize We podcast is brought to you by the Biohacking Index. Visit biohackingindex.com for ratings and reviews of your favorite wellness solutions and wellness providers.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. We are not medical professionals and do not provide medical advice. Consult a healthcare provider for any health concerns. Opinions expressed are not a substitute for professional medical guidance.
Hello, and welcome to the Optimize We podcast, where we share biohacking truths without the BS. I am joined today by the lovely, amazing Dr. Krishan Finister from Texas. She is the founder of her own practice, which is called Your Joy Psych, I believe, right?
That's correct.
And she also has started a new project, which is so near and dear to my heart. And one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to her today is because our mental health and our ability to learn and to feel supported, especially in our education systems and especially as children, is so vitally important to how we're able to optimize our health as adults. So without further ado, I want to welcome Krishan to the show today. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about the new project that you just started?
Well, thank you, Lindsay, for such a kind introduction. But yes, so you're correct. So I do have a for-profit, which is Your Joy Psychological Assessments. And through that endeavor with providing clinical evaluations in the community for autism, ADHD, learning disabilities, anxiety, and depression, it became very apparent that there was a large part of the community who could not access these clinical evaluations. Okay. And what a lot of people don't realize is that without the clinical evaluation done by most cases, the testing psychologist, that keeps you from getting access to other therapies and possibly medication if you need it from a physician. So yes, I've recently founded a nonprofit called the Texas Psychological Hive, which provides free diagnostic assessments for children and adults, especially for those with autism, ADHD, anxiety, so any type of neurodiversity, so that those in the community remove a barrier for them so they can get the access they need to those interventions.
That's amazing because, I mean, I don't know if many people know that I am ADHD. I misspoke to you the other day and said I'm ADD, like most people do, right?
There's no thing, and all the time.
So tell me, because as an ADD person, also on the spectrum of dyslexia, and then with children who are also dyslexic and have had to go through this process, I don't know if Texas is the same as New York, but it can be a very overwhelming process for the individual as well as for the parent. Yes. To go through this diagnostic process, and also very costly. So for example, like I, in New York, we have to really advocate for our kids. We have to spend hours researching different things. We have to proposition the school district in order to get them to approve a psych evaluation for our child. And then most of the time, they don't actually give you a diagnosis, which is really important for a lot of different reasons, but especially in this system that we're in right now, this healthcare system that we're in, you need diagnostic codes and those CPT codes in order to, like you said, get medication, get treatment. And so, you know, I have always known that there was like something about me, and I want to do your diagnostic test so that we can share that, those results of how messed up I am with
wow.
But I really truly find that like my ADD, ADHD, and my dyslexia leads me to become a better learner.
Yes.
But I struggled really hard in figuring that out on my own. So tell me a little bit more about like what type of testing you do, what you find, and then how that's really helping people navigate these kind of broken systems in our educational systems.
So actually, Lindsay, you kind of said a lot, because first and foremost, there's the school system and then there's the medical community. So sometimes individuals interchange them. And like you had mentioned, you're like, hey, I need that diagnosis, but the schools don't diagnose. The purpose of a psychoeducational evaluation in the school setting is to identify solely what does that child need or that student need to be successful in the school setting. And so I say that because just having an understanding that the two do not overlap between what a medical diagnosis and a school-based evaluation, that kind of helps clear up some confusion right there. Right. Because we also started mentioning costs. And so in the school setting, it is absolutely 100% free to get an evaluation, even for those parents who have chosen to do a private school for their child. You still have a legal right to have an access to a psychoeducational evaluation for the local school district in which you pay taxes for. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. So there's two separate systems.
That's very helpful. That's very helpful to know, because my oldest daughter just graduated from eighth grade, and we ended up pulling her after she completed her sixth grade year. We realized that all of the services and stuff that they had given her based off of her school evaluation were just not enough.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think it was also a great point. So if you think about the average child's school day, it's only about 6 to 7 hours. And that doesn't include if there's recess, the transitions. So really, I know sometimes it's frustrating for parents because they want more and more and more, which I totally can respect. But at the end of the day, the purpose of the school is to try to get your child the academics that they need to move successfully through the system and become an intelligent, informed adult enough to become a member of society, to get a job, and as well as to vote. So basically in the school setting, I know one of the ways we start is that we look at multiple tiered systems of support. So basically how it works in our country is that every child is a gen ed student. So if you're suspecting that your child may need additional supports, one, you need to find out the main stakeholders in your school setting. And it breaks my heart that that has been such a frustration for you and other parents, because it really isn't difficult to find out or to ask, hey, who's my school psychologist? Or who's in charge of special education? Before you even go specifically to a school psych, who's in charge of special education? That's step one. Also, too, while your child is going through school, if they may not have, because some disabilities are invisible. It may not be physically apparent that a child is struggling, especially if a child's in a classroom where they're quiet, they're going along to getting along, but they may have something silent going on, like dyslexia, where the child may be pushing through, but they're still not reaching their maximum potential. And that's where that multiple tiered systems of support comes into place. And so what's supposed to happen is that when we start doing all this standardized testing and we're doing grades, when teachers start looking at that data and they see a child is not making those grade level standards, then they're supposed to say, hey, I've identified a small group of students who are not really making those grade level standards. And so now we need to see how we can intervene. So is it that the child's comprehension is difficult? Is that they're not decoding on level? Are they just, you know, if you read it to the child, they're able to comprehend, but then they can't decode it on their own? What exactly is the need? Is it some signs of dyscalculia where they're not understanding the numbers? So basically, a lot of the data and the everyday work they do, teachers are supposed to be able to comb through that. And teachers should be supported within their schools with interventionists to say, hey, I think I have kids who need some more support. Can you come help me with this?
And I've seen that happen, not with my daughter. My daughter is, you know, she's had some anxiety because of this, but she's never lashed out. She never became that kid who was, you know, biting or hitting or bullying other kids because they were so frustrated at their own inability to comprehend what should be easy for them. You know, especially in like the lower grades, first grade, second grade, third grade, before it really starts to get to hard classwork that I can't even do as a 40-year-old person. I'm like, wait, what kind of math are you doing? You have to take everything apart and then put it back together.
I didn't learn it that way. So it's hard to, yes.
But a lot of teachers and parents think that kids who are acting out are just acting out because they're not great kids, or maybe something's wrong at home. They don't necessarily always go to, oh, well, they might be dyslexic, and it's really frustrating for them not to be able to put two and two together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, to look at there. from your testing perspective, when you are meeting with a child or even an adult child, right, mm-hmm. who's looking to get tested for college, right, mm-hmm. yes. at the collegiate level, what is the first thing that you're doing in terms of your evaluation?
Okay, so the first thing we do is what we call intake, okay? So in the clinical setting, we call intake, but in the school setting, that would look like, so all the stakeholders. So it would be the gen ed teacher, if possible, the parent, and the administrator. Okay. So first we want to kind of see what is the actual, what's the difficulty, or what is the area of weakness, as well as what the child's strengths are. Because I want to understand, so where is this child shining? And where can we help elevate them? And it's very similar in the clinical setting we call that intake, where we do the interview typically with the parents, where we kind of find out, hey, what is the area of need that you're seeing in your child? So that's the first step.
Right. That's great.
Yeah. So those initial interviews and those initial kind of when the school setting, sometimes you call them referral meetings or MTS multiple tiered meetings, where we come together to see, we think a child may need to be referred for special education services, because that kind of helps guide what battery of tests that I select. Okay. So like, oh, am I hearing?
You can't just like pick out, all right, well, without all of the data. So I'm a big data.
Exactly. And the same thing.
All the data first.
And I always tell parents in the school setting, as well as educators, and also to outside the school setting, let the data lead us. I'm following the data. My job is to collect the data and let it lead us to what this child's needs are. Absolutely. Because sometimes people will say, they just need to be tested for SPED. And I'm like, well, wait, there's 14 areas of eligibility. So there's vision impairment. There's learning, specific learning disabilities, which will capture like dyslexia. There's autism. You know, so when we're looking, we're testing children. We're not just throwing darts. We're looking at where the data is leading us to where the need is.
That's a much nicer way of saying it. Like, a lot of people, you know, just kind of do like the, oh, I think that my kid might have this. And in a lot of cases, I feel like the parents need to rely on experts, medical experts, mm-hmm. because the schools are, in some cases, not saying all the school districts are, but I feel like some of the school districts are disincentivized, because then they have to take money out of their pocket. They got to dig deep in their pockets to then send their kids, you know, the kids that are not getting their needs met in the school district. Like, I know, for example, if I wanted to have the school district pay for some of my daughter's school, which was very expensive, it was around $75,000 per year for seventh and eighth grade. And it's kindergarten through ninth grade, this school. And it's an amazing school. It's called Windward Orton-Gillingham. And we did a lot of research, but we at the last minute were like, we have to do this and we have to figure out a way to pay for it. Like, I sold a house to help pay for my daughter's education. And because I didn't want to go through that whole process of fighting, I couldn't fight anymore. Yeah. It's such a big fight. So the schools have their own processes. And yes, I think the teachers, I think the heads of special ed really do want to like leave no child behind. But the medical interventions, the medical data is really where I think parents miss the boat. They think that they're getting all of the right information from the schools, and they're not double checking that with medical verification.
Yeah, that's another great point. So that's another, and like I said, right from the bat, they're already two different separate systems. So yes, absolutely, at those well-check appointments are very important, especially when there's developmental concerns. But still, the truth of the matter is, for like dyslexia, you know, the medical community is not privy to the educational environment. They're not privy to what's going on in the school setting. But I will say, for mental health purposes, if you're seeing your child become withdrawn, if you're seeing your child start to have what we call somatization, like, oh, mommy, my stomach hurts or my head hurts, and you're taking up to the doctor and you're and the doctor's like, there's nothing physically wrong. However, that anxiety in the body or nervousness is showing up as a physical ailment, you know, or the child is just trying to get out of going to, you know, like it's a rites of passage. You go to school, you know, and it's becoming a stressor for that child. Then I think that's where the medical community can definitely come in and help.
Yeah, I 1000% agree. And we did not luckily have to have, we didn't have to pay additional. And on top of the cost of the school actually did a medical evaluation on our daughter prior to her coming into the school. But again, this is a very expensive school. These are very expensive tests. I know people that have paid $30,000 to have tests done for their kids, and they don't get that back. I mean, listen, I live in New York, okay?
I'm shocked. I'm like, wait, what? Sorry, like $30,000.
I don't know if Finisher is going to start raising her rates.
I was like, what? But yes, you're correct. There is definitely, because you're, when you think about to quantify that evaluation, you're paying for the time of the practitioner, and it takes a long time to become a psychologist, to get the license exam, you know, so you're paying for that. And as well as all of the testing materials we use are copyrighted. So all those assessments, we have to pay publishers to use those empirical measures. So when you think about the evaluation, Lindsay, it's not just qualitative where I get that interview where you're telling me your story. It's also quantitative. And those are those behavior rating scales. And so all those scientists who studied and gave those measurements or say, okay, this many five-year-olds should do this many behaviors, for us to use those resources, it costs. So that's the reason why those evaluations can be so costly.
That's really interesting. I wonder, do you think AI is going to take over that at some point? Like someone's just going to put all those tests into AI and then, I don't know.
You know, that's a great question. I will say another component of the evaluation is that every one of our psychological testing evaluations should yield a psychological report. So in the school setting, a psychoeducational report, where we're documenting what we did, why we did it, and how we did it, and basically, does this child meet disability criteria to receive specialized services? Very similar in the clinical setting. Same thing. We do the intake. Why are we here? What do we observe? What do the measures say? And does this individual meet a clinical diagnosis, yay or nay? And those psychological reports, at a minimum, are like 10 plus pages. Oftentimes, get clients back and like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this. I'm like, yes, it's not just one page. We really want to do a thorough background of who you are, what is going on, and how we can best assist you. And so those psychological reports, like I said, 10 plus pages at a minimum. And yes, so I have started utilizing AI to help support me and to help produce these evaluations and reports faster. Now, you still need the expertise because you can't trust the AI completely. Things are not always correct, but it's definitely a great tool to kind of help with the completion of these psychological evaluations.
AI is definitely imperfect. And I think that that's a very important message for a lot of people, especially the people listening to this podcast, because this whole podcast is dedicated to helping people optimize their health. A big portion of optimization is, you know, not looking too far in the future, as my mom would call it, borrowing problems from tomorrow. Stop doing that. And AI is really causing all of us to go, oh my God, well, I uploaded my MRI and AI said that I'm dying. No, well, the doctor said this is very common and that you really only need like PT. You don't need injections. You don't need surgery. You don't need any of that kind of stuff. You know, our minds are not meant to keep us happy. They're meant to keep us safe. And so when we are in a fear state, what do? We jump to the worst possible scenario because we need to be able to run from that tiger because that's how our chemistry is built, right? We see the tiger, we run from the tiger. But if we don't see the tiger, then we don't know to run from the tiger. And in this particular case, especially when it comes to like the mental health of the parent who's taking care of the kid, we're always jumping to the worst possible scenario. And what you might find with your data, with your clinical evidence, as well as from the, you know, the emotional and the, just the behavioral evidence that you see in the student or in the person, is maybe not as bad as we tend to think it is.
And you brought up a lot of good points, actually, because one, about the evaluation process. You know, at this point, I can't see how AI can build a rapport with a client. You know, when you think about what we do, and in both environments, it's not just the client. I also build rapport with those educators, the teachers that I had to get data from, the parents to let them know that I'm a trusting person to allow me to do this. Same thing in the clinical setting. I have to build that rapport with the client to be able to extract. I don't want to say extract, but in order to be able to get the information that I need to do a thorough evaluation on them. So at this point, I mean, I'm not scared. AI, like I said, is anything else is a tool. It's a tool to assist us. I remember when text messaging first started, like back in the aughts, the OOs, and I was like, I want to call. Who's going to use this? Clearly, it's the best tool ever. So I think, you know, if AI will be just another iteration in our technological growth, we learn to use it as a tool and maybe not a crutch. So I don't know. That's my hope for humanity.
It's true. And we as parents, so we're the same age. I think I'm a little bit older than you are. We grew up in the 90s. I had a beeper. I was walking around New York City thinking I want
a beeper.
And a pocket full of quarters, just in case, you know, my boo texted me or my friends were like, where are you at or whatever. And then I was one of the first people to have a cell phone in the city. I think I had a cell phone in 1999. And it was like just a Radio Shack. It had a little thing that came down. I didn't have any friends that had cell phones, so I would just walk around Manhattan just talking to myself. And every once in a while, the phone would ring, and I'd jump up. But we have to remember that we're only 30 years from there. Not even 30 years from there. 25 years from not even being able to call each other and say, like, hey, where are you? You know, you're supposed to be at this party 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And so we need to be a little bit more understanding of this day and age that our children are growing up in. I know you have a 10-year-old. I have a 10-year-old. My 10-year-old is pretty tech savvy. I'm sure your 10-year-old is pretty tech savvy.
Yeah.
They're getting bombarded with all of this information all of the time. And in a school setting, they can't switch it off. They don't have that capacity yet. Our brains, to my knowledge, are not fully developed until what, like 26, 25?
Yep. Absolutely. It's that frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe is where it all happens. When I'm explaining my evaluation process, I say, hey, this is like your cockpit. Fly right, fly left. Don't do that. Land that plane. And so that's what neurodiversity is. When that frontal lobe is just operating differently than what we would expect it to. And so that's what a lot of my measures look at, to see how is that frontal lobe functioning.
So we talked about the testing, the difference between school. We talked about the, you know, the medical side of it. We talked about the anxiety around it for parents, and then also how we need to not borrow problems from tomorrow. But from a data perspective, I'm really interested to learn more about what you're actually finding. How many of these kids these days, and has this changed over the course of your career, how many kids are coming up with dyslexia? How many are coming up with, you know, on the spectrum in some something? I don't know.
So in my experience, I will say I started grad school in 2007 and graduated in 2010. And so the biggest increase that I've seen is autism evaluations. Mm-hmm. And a lot, that increase has just been just astonishing. So I remember one of my professors said that when she was in graduate school, now mind you, she had been in graduate school in the early 80s, late 70s. She said her professor said it was like 1 in 10,000 that you would see a child with autism. Now that number is something like 1 in 200.
Wow.
So a few things have happened there. I think that we have just become more sensitive, just and aware of neurodiversity. Okay. and just how that spectrum of autism truly looks. And so even in my own career, when I started working, I was licensed by 2010, as I mentioned, after my internship, I was licensed in 2010. And I, as a school psych, there was like an autism team that would come and do evals. So maybe three or four a school year. Now, in my role, I probably do three or four a month. Okay. That's just in the span of, you know, we're talking about a span of about 15 years, just that change. So in regards to like dyslexia and ADHD, I feel like those have been pretty steady. That's been pretty steady. We are now seeing, I will speak to gender, that more females are being identified with like ADHD, whereas before, I think it was a squeaky wheel situation where males are acting out. But now I think we're paying more attention to how that will present in biologically born females, especially during puberty and then a menopause, when those hormonal changes are starting to happen to call like, I have some women who are perimenopause or menopause age in my clinic who will come. They're like, I don't know what's going on, this brain fog that I have all of a sudden. Before, my executive functioning, you know, and most women are the executive functioning, the executive in their home, you know, they're, you know, getting the lunches together, getting dinners together, getting appointments together. And as their hormones start to change, they start to have difficulty. So I do see a lot of women going through hormonal changes starting to come to get ADHD evaluations.
Oh, that's why I'm signing up.
Yeah.
On your list, you didn't realize this.
Yeah, it is. I did like, what is going where before things were like so clear. And now it's just those daily activities where you're juggling what you have to do, what your children have to do, or your spouse has to do, becomes a little bit more difficult. And I think that's attributed to those hormonal changes.
Now, one thing I've had to do going through hormonal changes, and I've noticed that it's a similar thing when your teenage daughters are going through the same hormonal changes. And I can't speak to boys because I grew up in a house full of women and I only have daughters. But, and I'm a woman, but I'm, you know, going through my early stages of perimenopause and they're going through their puberty stages. And I'm realizing we just don't have the same patience like with ourselves. And so that frustration, that anxiety kicks in like almost immediately instead of what it used to be, which was, all right, just like take a deep breath, like take a pause, look through that again, reread something. And then, oh, that makes sense. No, it's just like throwing things at the window and I can't do this anymore. And it's so frustrating. And it's really hard to biohack and think about your future and how to prolong your life when you're just in a constant state of anxiety and frustration. Yeah. And so it's so vitally important what you're doing. I wish that you did this across the whole country and not just in Texas.
Yeah. That's okay, because you can find your local testing site. They're out there.
And I want to go back to the first question that I asked you, because now that we've identified that this is such an important thing that you're doing, and that there are more and more kids, you know, females with ADHD and dyslexia that are being identified, and then kids that are on
biologically born females with autism. That's also, too, another area that we've really become more sensitive to, and how those characteristics present in those who are biologically born female.
And I think having that data is so important because, in my perspective, I'm a certified culinary medicine chef through the Harvard School of Public Health, and I've helped people, even children, reduce inflammation, heal their gut, because your gut is supposed to be your second brain, but it's really like your first brain. And you've got serotonin receptors in there. You've got all sorts of ways of healing your mental health and having a greater capacity for stress and anxiety and also focus without the brain fog if you eat better, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's other things, other toxins that are known to create leaky gut, that are environmental toxins, mold exposure, even the stuff that's like in our water, heavy metals, and then just sugar in general. But if you don't have a diagnosis, you're way less likely to actually do something about it.
Yes.
And potentially some of these children actually do need medical interventions and therapies to go along with it. So tell us about, obviously we know that this, the data is really important. How are you helping people who can't afford it now?
So basically I'm helping those who can't afford it through my nonprofit. You know, I'm providing free evaluations for those who are underinsured, no insured, and even those who have Medicaid, Medicare, or other healthcare exchanges provided through the government. Sometimes those insurance plans are difficult for providers to get credentialed on. So if you don't have providers that are available to provide the services, then even if you have that insurance, it's not helping you in that particular state. So again, I've just tried to remove that barrier to provide those three evaluations through the nonprofit.
That's amazing. So what's the name of your nonprofit?
The Texas Psychological Hive. You can find me at www.thetexaspsychhive.org.
Texas Psych Hive.
Uh-huh. Yes. thetexaspsychhive.org.
I like it. And you touched on something, because not all of the providers are equal either. You know, in talking to you, you are very different from a lot of the providers that I talked to in New York. I wanted to kind of bang my head against the wall at some of these meetings because they weren't really diving deep enough into the data. I appreciate not only the fact that you dive super deep into the data and you don't do tests just based off of like, oh, the parents just say that you need this, or the parents just think that you need that. You're doing it based off of your clinical expertise. And you're also able to explain things in such an easy to understand way. I wish you could be a neuroscientist. I wish you could be a surgeon, because there are so many providers that are out there that actually make things worse for us parents, because they just don't explain things in a way that, you know, we can understand and take an action on. So I just wanted to give you that credit. Thank you very much for being who you are and doing what you do.
Well, thank you for that kindness. And I truly try to, I don't mean to sound cliche, I love bees, as I keep talking about hives, and because bees are so powerful, but I really try to be the person that I need. And I think you brought up a good point that, and even sometimes, because I do this every day and in, you know, every day for the last almost 15, 16 years, I just think back when I had my first child and my doctor and I felt like at times, I remember once I told her, I said, I understand you do this every day, but this is my first experience. And I feel like that was really eye-opening for me. And that's how I try to approach the parents, educators, clinicians, even doctors who call me like, well, what does this mean? Or I feel like this, just to even explain what the school setting is, or even explain to parents in my clinic, hey, you know, this is what I'm looking for. So I think it's really important for people to make a informed, we're big on informed consent, whether school-based or clinical. And I want parents to have informed consent truly to understand to the best of their knowledge what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So I just try to be the person that I know I'm needed in situations such as this.
And that's exactly why I'm doing this too. I mean, I got really, really sick after I got hit by a car when I was pregnant with my daughter.
I remember you shared that.
And then she started getting sick, and there was no information out there. I basically was just kind of floating around, flying blind, trying to figure out what's the best modality for her. She should be taking that medication. She should be taking a supplement. You know, is there a deeper level of data that I can glean to help make better decisions as her, you know, her advocate when she was only 3-4 years old? I mean, she's still only 10. She still can't make decisions for herself. And, you know, that there's not a lot of information out there, which is why I started this podcast and started the Biohacking Index to help people find efficacious solutions that are going to be really transformative in their lives or whoever they're caring for, and help them move towards a happier, longer, better life. That's my whole vision. So I'm really drawn to people like you. You know, we just met. And typically I have like my friends and people that I know really well on this podcast, and I just was drawn to you and your energy. So I appreciate that. Now, you're trying to raise money for this 501c3.
Yes, I am. I'm trying to raise money for it because, like I said, I've got a team in place. We're ready to go. We just need the funds so that we can just really make that impact in the community.
And how can, if people are moved by this conversation, they live in Texas, or even if they don't live in Texas and they want to help you developed this hive. I love it. I can like see all of the magic happening with your organization. How can they donate? How can they be a part of what you're doing? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people like me who have gone through hell and back to try to help their kid or help themselves and want to give back to their community.
Yeah, and the support is out there. Absolutely. Please, again, visit my website, www.thetexaspsychhive.org. You can donate right on the page. I have some events coming up at this fall in the beginning of the year. And so if you'd like to donate your time, we would love that. You know, it definitely does take a village. And one thing I like to say, Lindsay, because across both of my businesses, is that I want people to be encouraged, be empowered, and be joyful. So I'm not saying that everything's going to be happy-go-lucky all the time, that you have no problems, but I do believe you can find joy in your life and when you're at. So even if you're struggling, it's like, hey, there's support out there, and just trying to be able to find it. And so I'm just trying to be another, just another vehicle or avenue in the community to help support mental health and remove a barrier to mental health supports and access.
That's beautiful. I love that, because you're absolutely right. Even in the darkest of moments, even when you feel like you're breaking down, which I felt many, many times, it's not just my oldest daughter. It's my youngest daughter has an IEP also. And then going through all of the medical stuff with her, and then feeling like a terrible mother to my middle child who like just kind of got lost in the sauce, and going through a divorce and the pandemic and all the things, you really feel like you're in the dark and you're alone and you don't have to.
Right.
You can work with people like yourself to find the light and find the joy in any situation. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and grace is a powerful thing. So give yourself that grace. You know, it's, you know, we've never done this life before. None of us have. So, and I will just speak to, I will say that is the positive about your platform and other tools where you can really connect. I know the internet, I know it's that dopamine hit, but really that connection. So you, another parent can hear your story and is like, well, I had concerns in my child's education too. Or even, you know, even somebody's like, you know what? Maybe Dr. Finister is right. I should get an evaluation, you know, so I can really see what's going on with myself or my child. Like, you don't have to suffer in silence. So I'm just all about that grace. I need it and I try to give it.
That's beautiful. And more moms, especially like you were saying, we're the executive functioners of the household. We're making all the magic happen. We're making sure everybody's fed and happy and well cared for. We often put ourselves last. So if the only thing you do, you know, so many of my clients and my friends are like, what is self-care mean? Who are these moms that can like go and, you know, go on girls trips and have time to like get facials and massages and manicures? Not like, we don't have time for that. If you can just take a couple of moments to just take a step back and give yourself some grace, like that's
absolutely
probably one thing.
Some parents reach out to me and say, you know, I just want to have a consultation. And after we've talked, they're like, okay, I need to think about this, but I have the information now. Sometimes even just getting the information may be self-care. You know, like you didn't even, you know, just the fact that you took a moment to address something that you knew was an issue or potential problem, I think is amazing. I know, and I agree. Sometimes I think we feel like self-care has to be fancy. I would love to go to Sonoma and go to like a spa with my girlfriends. But sometimes self-care is just, you know what? I'm going to take, I know daycare, I have to pick up by 6. Sometimes I take 30 minutes and just eat a snack in my car. That little 30 minutes where I'm not answering the phone, I'm not answering a text before I shift from home to after school activities. I just need 30 minutes to just woosah. And that's important too.
It's so important. It's so vitally important to take that time for yourself. We often don't get it. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I told my kids this morning, I'm like, you guys are going to start taking the bus, because just driving you around takes away from my free time, you know, and my alone time. I need everybody out of the house, and then I can just be for, even if it's just 10 minutes.
Yeah, just a little moment to kind of say, okay, so we either give yourself a high five, we got through the morning, because mornings are difficult for me. We got through the morning, or you know what? I look back, I achieved the goal today. Even my thing is drinking water. Mm-hmm. If I finish that Stanley Cup, yes. I mean, these little wins are important, especially when you have a busy life and juggling a family.
It's so true. It's so true. Well, I'm so glad that we got a chance to meet you, to get all of these nuggets of knowledge and goodness and inspiration and motivation. If someone wants to do a consultation, can they call you from any state, or do they have to be in Texas?
Well, they have to be in Texas because I'm only licensed in Texas. Okay. But if people want to reach out at info@thetexaspsychhive.org, feel free to shoot me an email and I can gladly explain evaluations to you with the process and try to direct you to somebody in your state.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for all of your time. This has been a great conversation. And I really do hope that everybody goes to thetexaspsychhive.org, yes, checks it out. Even if you can make a $10, $20 donation, I'm sure all of it goes a very long way.
Every little bit helps tremendously. And again, we're just trying to remove that barrier to mental health in the community. People always tell mental health, mental health, mental health. But what does that actually look like? And one of the first steps is getting a good, thorough evaluation. So any help will be greatly appreciated.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Christian Finister. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to catching up after I get to have my evaluation done.
All right. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.